meetings before, and so I'll be very brief. Ed is the Chauncey J. Medbury Chair in Management. He's Professor of Economics and Statistics, and he is Director of the UCLA Anderson Forecast. So you can read his predictions in the LA Times, sometimes on the front page, and so he can't escape. Ed is, again, there's not time to talk about all the things he's done. A couple of things I will mention. His most recent book is Macroeconomic Patterns and Stories. That came out in 2008 from Springer and has a good deal of stuff on the issues we're talking about. A couple of famous pieces that he wrote and that are quite accessible, I will say, on this issue, In Search of Stolper Samuelson. Where was that, Ed, published?
It's a Brookings.
A Brookings paper. And it was on this question, again, it was like the first phase in this discussion about 15 years ago. And more recently, he wrote a review of Friedman's The World is Flat, very not only critical review, but very broad-ranging, in which he presented his own views on this question, impact of globalization and practically everything whatsoever on the economy, actually, in the Journal of Economic Literature in 2006. Highly recommended. It's a kind of big synthesis piece, and it's really accessible for non-specialists.
So I'm totally taken aback by Richard's presentation, because I thought we were going to talk about the demand for labor and the supply of labor, and we got into this capital market. So I'm going to kick it off by giving my own view on what happened, and who are the culprits. The culprits, as I see them, are, first of all, Greenspan and the Fed, who gave us those incredibly low interest rates. Their job was to, first and foremost, to make sure the financial systems are working effectively. And Mr. Greenspan was warned in 2003 and 2004 that the mortgage market had had serious deterioration in lending standards. These mortgage-backed securities, subprime mortgages were given to people who could never really qualify for them. They were being qualified for products that are called 228 products. We had 2 years of teaser rates and then 28 years of reality. And the teaser rates came from Mr. Greenspan, because he gave us those incredibly low interest rates. Even though the economy was healthy, he had what I call deflation dread disorder. FOMC committee meeting in Washington in 2002 stayed up late one night and turned on a sci-fi channel. And what they watched was how Godzilla and deflation destroyed the island of Japan. And that scared them so much. They said, we cannot let deflation come to the United States. So they gave us incredibly low interest rates. 2 or 3 years later, after the subprime market was totally out of control, after the appreciation had created this momentum-type trading where buyers were imagining prices could only go up, the product itself, the basic business model of the subprime market, required the home to be refinanced every 2 years, and only refinanceable if you had appreciation. The banks did not make much money off the origination of these loans. They were going to make it over and over every 2 years, because you'd be doing a refinancing. That was the business model, where it's working great as long as you had that high appreciation. But unless the home was paying for itself, we were putting people into these homes who never had anywhere near the income level to be able to actually afford them. And Mr. Greenspan was warned about that. And he had read Ayn Rand and had really come to the conclusion that markets were self-regulating. And therefore, he didn't need to step in. And moreover, the regulatory reach of the Fed didn't extend to Orange County, where all these things were being written, because this was not part of the Federal Reserve System. He didn't think he had much control over it, but he did have control over interest rates. These teaser rates that he provided set that market going. And he ended that game when the interest rates were raised in 2004 and 2005. Not surprisingly, That kills off the subprime market. So you had a class of American home buyers, potential buyers, were suddenly completely shut out of the marketplace. We raised the home ownership rates from about 65 to 69%. Well, we're moving pretty quickly back to 65%, because that last 4% could never never had the income to really qualify for a loan. So the first error is Mr. Greenspan. I think the Fed has learned its lesson. I don't think that will ever happen again. I think that those extraordinary low interest rates, although they were kind of getting them now, but not with an overheated housing market or an overheated mortgage-backed security market. Then the next thing is we give courses in what's called financial engineering in the business school. Most business schools have financial engineering. Well, that's a mechanical metaphor, and it gives the practitioners a sense of knowledge that they don't truly have, because the financial system is a human, organic system, constantly innovating, constantly changing. But if you think you're a financial engineer, you can design these incredibly complex derivatives, mortgage-backed securities, multiple tranches, credit default swaps. You can design them, and you can price them because you can evaluate the probabilities of all these events. And models that were being used for valuing within these firms that were issuing the mortgage-backed securities were pretty complex and beyond the ability of the rating agencies to really evaluate. The rating agencies went along with that, and there's a sort of a mixed incentive system, because the rating agencies are paid by not the bond buyers, but the people who issue the bonds. And they're not going to be happy if they don't get the AAA rating for their favorite security. So there's a mixed incentive. But I think the main thing is that we were dealing with the kind of attitudes toward the financial system, which is appropriate for mathematics and appropriate for engineering, but not appropriate for human systems. What I want to say is that we should use three-valued logic. Two-valued logic is true, false, yes, no, a AAA or not AAA. Three-valued logic is yes, no, and I don't know. Mm-hmm. So when you come for human systems, there's a lot of I don't know. So instead of having been rated AAA, these mortgage-backed securities should have been rated AAA-H, meaning hypothetical, meaning that there are models that suggest that these are AAA, but they've never been tested under stressful conditions. Even engineers understand that. You know, if you design an aircraft, you don't get certified for flying commercially until it goes through flight certification tests, in which you test it under all kinds of conditions. But we were selling these things as if they were flight-worthy without ever having been tested. So to me, the villains are Mr. Greenspan, who should have been much more concerned and much more watchful about a market that was totally out of control, and a market that, from a forecasting standpoint, is extremely important. We've had 10 downturns since World War II, and 8 of them have been signaled by problems in the housing market. And I went to that Jackson Hole conference in 2007, arguing. They asked me to give a paper on housing and the business cycle. I changed the title to Housing is the Business Cycle, meaning that that's the most important sector. The next sector is consumer durables. The Fed, if it wants to control these extreme U.S. cycles, should not be thinking of it as a business cycle. It's a consumer cycle, with homes and automobiles the most critical things. And it's pretty easy. You don't have to use the price level to determine whether homes are out of control. The normal building is about 1.5 million units. If you've got 2 million units being built and it's getting more, you've got an overheated market. And that was 2003 and 2004. The time that the Fed has some influence is not when the market's going south, because it doesn't matter what the interest rates are. You can't afford to own a home when it's falling in price 10% per year. The real interest rate is high no matter whether the nominal rate is zero. The time that the Fed really has some influence is when the passions are hot but not out of control. When there's a lot of buyers trying to find homes, that's the time to cool down the market with higher interest rates. So you think about the cycle, there's really only one time the Fed can intervene effectively, which is just when Mr. Greenspan did exactly the exact opposite, where he threw fuel onto the fire. So I don't think we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater. We just need to make sure that our rating agencies are doing a better job, I think, by using three-valued logic in an appropriate way. But most importantly, to make complaints about the Federal Reserve and make sure that they're doing a job more effectively than they did. There was enough noise out there, enough comments at the time, that they should have been more sensitive to it, and they weren't. Now get back to this question about what I thought was the topic for today, which is what's the shape of the labor demand curve and what impact does globalization have upon wage rates in the United States, which I'm not sure what your answer was, but I'll give you a variety of answers so you can pick the one that you like of this. But rather than getting right into it, I want to talk about the craft of economics. Something I try to get across in my courses and whenever I teach an economics course, international or otherwise, is saying that you have to recognize that a wise conversation about economics issues has three components into it. It has clear questions, it has frameworks or conceptual models, and ideally more than one. You don't want to get overcommitted to a particular framework. And thirdly, you've got to have data in there to help you inform the about which framework is most important or to estimate parameters within the framework that you have to select. And an efficient, appropriate conversation has balance among all these things. So there's discussion about what the questions are, some discussion about what the frameworks are and the data. Most conversations in economics are seriously imbalanced in the sense that many don't make any clear reference to what the questions are. Many will jump over the conceptual frameworks. I imagine they can get to the data without having theory. Some are just data descriptions with neither questions nor theory. So when it comes to thinking about this issue of trade and globalization, let's think first of all what the questions are, because often these are not very clear. And in order to get into that, I ask the preliminary question, why is economics sliced the way it is? History is sliced by areas and by times. You can study medieval European history, or you can study Middle Eastern modern history. The sociology department is sliced in yet another way. Economics is sliced as economics is international economics, industrial organization, as labor economics. Why is it sliced that way? Well, the answer is that economics is very self-consciously an interventionist discipline. It deals with public policy interventions. So we have these disciplines, these subject matters, which are how should the governments intervene in markets. In labor, there's a variety of interventions, minimum wages, subsidies for education. Industrial organization is interventions in the competitive in markets for competition among firms. International, the reason we have international economics is because countries reserve the right to intervene in cross-border commerce in a way that they don't intervene in internal commerce. So the questions have to do with interventions. A causal, let's understand the causal. Second point is a causal statement requires a clear but-for hypothetical. So if you say, does international trade cause low wages? That doesn't evoke a very clear but-for hypothetical, because there are an infinity of different ways in which you could have a reduced or altered nature of international trade. So it's inappropriate. It's very inappropriate to say multinationals cause this, because in order to say that, you have to tell me what it is, what kind of world you imagine if we didn't have multinationals. The same thing is really true with China. You say about China, can we say China causes low wages? Well, in order to make that clear, you'd have to talk about if we didn't have China, wouldn't we have a different Mexico, a different Indonesia, and a different Brazil? So are we holding those countries fixed? Or you got to make it clear what the hypothetical is. And the one that I think is most clear, and the one that has been debated for a couple centuries in the United States or in the international literature, is would tariffs on imports raise wages? That's really what gave rise to the Heckscher-Lehne model, a discussion fundamentally about whether labor was going to be hurt by trade liberalization. So let's understand that, and this is an error that's made. I'm not sure whether you're going to follow this picture completely, but I want to make sure that the effect of China is not the same as the effect of tariffs. So here's a production possibility frontier. We have two products. The original equilibrium is this one here, where the production point is here and the consumption point is here. I don't know how many people recognize this. But this represents the terms of trade, and this country gains from that opportunity to trade. At that terms of trade, it has gains, and it consumes out here, which is beyond its production possibilities frontier, as a consequence of that terms of trade. Now, China can enter in and alter the terms of trade
and it can alter it so much that this country doesn't trade anymore.
Well, that's a kind of impact that can't be offset by raising barriers, because at this point there are absolutely no trade taking place at all. So don't imagine that there are barriers that will necessarily offset the impact that China has on global trade. A lot of people say, well, what we ought to do is impose tariffs because China's having this horrendous impact on the U.S. income distribution. Well, it's not the same thing. It's very possible that China can make us worse off, but that trade protection is going to make us even worse off. So China is not, the hypothesis of China is not the same as tariffs. So theory, I hope you'll forgive me if I roll through these alternative conceptual frameworks, because they imply very different ways of looking at the data. And we'll look at those data through the lenses of each one of these frameworks. We'll do the Ricardian model, the Ricardo-Weiner model, the Heckscher-Lind model, and I'll make some comments about limit pricing or the threat of competition, which causes empirical problems that I think are very extreme. It makes it very difficult to give a compelling explanation with regard to the impact of globalization on wages. Or another way to anticipate my final point, but go back to my first point, if we allow three-valued logic in international economics and in labor economics, we're very much in the third pole where we really don't know the impact of globalization, and we know relatively little about the impact of tariffs or protectionism on the U.S. Labor market, for reasons that I'll try to make clear here in a minute. So this is the Ricardian model. And Ricardian's world is a happy world because individuals are partners, not competitors. If you have a comparative advantage in one activity, I have a comparative advantage in the other, there's an incentive for you to specialize in what you're good at and for me to specialize in what I'm good at, and we're both made better off. We're partners in that exchange. It's the picture of Ricardian equilibrium, not unlike what I had before, except that we have a constant labor cost embedded in that straight line production possibility frontier. So if China alters our terms of trade, say if we have a comparative advantage in knowledge-based work, and China enters into the knowledge-based sector, has so much knowledge that China decides to specialize in knowledge work, then there's going to be a global terms of trade against us, which will lower our gains from trade. But that doesn't mean that trade isn't good. It just means that the gains are less. It doesn't suggest that tariff barriers are the solution. In fact, that's not the case at all. So the policy implication of the Ricardian model is enjoy and don't intervene. Sometimes you're going to have specialized comparative advantage and make a lot of gains from trade, and sometimes you don't. But the interventions that you imagine that on the external front that you imagine could make you better off, those are misplaced. Possibly you have to worry about maintaining your comparative advantage with infrastructure, educational, R&D investment. But don't intervene in the product markets. Enjoy that. If you intervene, you're going to end up being made worse off. Everybody's made worse off because the gains of trade are going to disappear or be greatly attenuated. Now, this is the Ricardo-Weiner model. In this model, there is a mobile factor, labor, that can be used either in agriculture or in manufacturing. And in agriculture, there's a specific asset, land, which is not used in manufacturing. In manufacturing, there's a specific asset, which is capital, that is not used in agriculture. So there's two specific assets and one mobile asset, one mobile factor of production, which is labor. And what we have is total labor force is indicated by this line segment. And this picture is allocating that total labor force between agriculture and manufacturing. So pick a line on this horizontal segment, pick a point on this horizontal segment. As you move in this direction, you're adding more workers into agriculture and fewer in manufacturing. These downward sloping curves are labor demand curves, or they are the values of the marginal products of labor in the two activities, agriculture and manufacturing. And the declining nature of this value measure product is as you add more and more workers in agriculture, those workers are starting to crowd the fields. The fields are limited in size, and that crowding causes a lower and lower value of the marginal product. The same thing is true with manufacturing, is as you add more workers into the manufacturing activity, you tend to crowd the limited capital and drive down that value of the marginal product.
And this is the equilibrium in this kind of a model in which the wage rate is set to equilibrate the value of the marginal product in both sectors.
So now we can ask what happens if there's an increase in agriculture. Say if agriculture is an imported product, you raise the tariff on agriculture, you increase the value of the marginal product, the nominal value of the marginal product.
So this shifts up, and that higher wage requires you to move workers into the agricultural sector. Not surprisingly, you're raising the price of agriculture, so you're going to move some of your workforce from manufacturing to agriculture.
Now, you remember your beginning economics, the workers are paid their marginal product, not the value of the marginal product, they're paid the physical product, in effect. So if you're working in the agricultural sector, you get paid, if the marginal product is 2 bushels of wheat, you get 2 bushels of wheat. In the manufacturing sector, if your marginal product is 1 shirt, you get 1 shirt. And then you have to, if you're working in manufacturing, then you're going to take that shirt and go into the product market and trade for food. If you've got the food and you want to get the shirt, then you'll trade in the product market. That's how it works. So in order to decide how well off the factors are, you just have to look at the value of the marginal product. And in these kinds of models with constant returns of scale, that value of the marginal product depends upon the labor intensity. So as the labor per land ratio increases, because you're moving more workers into agriculture, the value of the marginal product goes down, and workers are paid less in the agricultural sector. The opposite is true in manufacturing, because you're ending up with fewer workers in manufacturing. That capital is spread over a smaller workforce. So workers are better off in terms of the agricultural product, could buy more food. Did I say that right? No, less food. But they're better off in terms of the manufacturing product. So consequently, whether workers are made better off or worse off in this model depends upon what they consume. You raise the price of food. If they like a lot of food, that's to their disadvantage if they consume food. If, on the other hand, they consume the manufacturing product, then they're made better off. So here's the sort of summary, which is that the more labor-intensive methods in agriculture lower the marginal physical product of labor, but the high increase the marginal physical product of land. So land is made better off in terms of its physical product. The less labor-intensive manufacturing methods in manufacturing, because you're moving workers out of that sector, means higher physical products of labor and lower physical products of capital. So here, next slide sums this up then. Land is better off. So you raise the price of the food, land is definitely better off. Whether it consumes the manufacturing product, whether landowners consume the manufacturing product or the agricultural product, they're better off by virtue of this protection. But the capital is made worse off because it has to pay a higher wage. Some of its potential rent is dissipated through higher wages. And then labor benefits are either benefited or made worse off, depending upon what it consumes. So this sets up an empirical enterprise in which you focus on the prices that the workers, prices of the products that the workers are consuming, and you study the extent to which those prices are being driven down as a consequence of global competition. It has to do with what they're consuming. If this is your conceptual framework, what matters is the prices of the products that the workers are consuming. So an importer, this is an example, if you talk about the overall apparel consumer price index relative to the overall CPI, there's been a dramatic reduction in the price of apparel, which is 1.5 down to 1, and now it's down to 1/2. So there's a 50% reduction in the price of apparel relative to products overall from 1987 until today. So that would be supportive of the idea that the workers are consequently better off. It's not just apparel, but there's a lot of these other labor-intensive activities that are a lot cheaper now, electronics especially, and textiles and footwear. And that makes workers better off to the extent that that's what they consume. So if you do the wages, this is manufacturing wages,
And if you divide by the overall CPI, then it looks like there's a distressing the 60s, the 40s, 50s, 60s. These were times of rising real wages in manufacturing. And then there's this big halt that we've all been studying around 1980, in which the wages have calmed down a little bit, been very flat. But the big thing is totally flat for several decades versus long episodes of rising real wages. But if you denominate, not if you divide not by the CPI, but the apparel CPI, so that workers are concentrating their consumption on apparel, then this is continuing to increase. They're not being made worse off, they're made better off. And there's a new paper by Christine Broda and John Romalis who say, using household data on non-durable consumption between 1994 and 2005, we document much of the rise in income inequality has been offset by a relative decline in the price index of the poor. So these folks look at the products that are differentially consumed by the poor relative to the rest of society and find out that these prices have actually been declining. That's a Walmart effect. The Walmart effect works to the great advantage. So if you do the
They created a new, poor CPI,
one that uses the budget fractions of the poor, and it's being much driven by the Walmart effect. Now, that's the Ricardo Vino. So we've done Ricardo's model. The Ricardo model says, keep your ugly government hands off the external commerce, or we're all going to be made worse off. The Ricardo Vinder says, oh, maybe we actually gain, maybe our poor people actually gain from the cheaper trade. The third model is this Heckscher-Lehman model, and these are the two equations that shook the world. Olin, early on, wrote a book in which he used the traditional communication style, which is literary and narrative, arguing that tariff reductions would not likely lower real wages of workers. There's a great debate in the first half of the 20th century about whether the tariff reductions that were on the table would benefit or work to the disadvantage of the workers, not unlike where we are now. And Olin wrote his early papers, arguing that it was unlikely that, after all, there are gains from trade. He's got a Ricardian thinking, there are gains from trade, and the tariff reduction surely is going to create gains, help countries get the Ricardian gains, and he couldn't think of a reason why all factors wouldn't benefit to some extent from those. The gains of labor might get a smaller share, smaller part of that gain, but surely labor is going to get some gain out of that because there's gains to be distributed. Well, these are the zero profit conditions that Samuelson used to disprove that idea. The very simple conceptual framework in which there are two products that are being traded, product one and product two. The W is the wage rate to the workers, and R is a rental rate on capital. These A's are factor intensities. So AL1 is the labor intensity in the first product, and AK1 is the capital intensity in the first product, capital per unit of output. Well, you can see this is two equations and four unknowns. The unknowns are the wage rate and the technologies, the input intensities, I'll take as given. And then this is two equations with four unknowns. The prices are unknown, and the wage and the rental rate on capital. But if we could take prices as determined in the external marketplace through global competition, then we could solve for both the wage rate and the rental rate on capital. So the first surprising implication, that means to invert the system and solve for W and R as a function of P1 and P2. That establishes the Beijing wages of send Beijing point, because it means that all you need to know is the prices of the tradables in order to solve for the wage rates and the rental rate on capital, which is also the factor price equalization theorem. So to the extent that countries are producing the same pair of commodities, in order to have zero profits,
in both sectors, we've got to choose the wage rates and the rental rate in our capital appropriately. But this also allows you to talk about the sensitivity of wages to the price changes. That's a Stolper-Samuelson. That's what we were just talking about with regard to the Ricardian and Ricardo Binder model. So this is the Stolper-Samuelson theorem, which was written in, I think, the early 40s. Extremely powerful mathematics. Although I'm going to say that what Olin wrote was useful but not valid, where what Samuelson wrote was valid but not useful. I'm not sure you completely understand my point there, but there's an important one. This is the Samuelson valid point, a mathematical point, meaning he just inverted that 2x2 system that we had. And from that, you can get his Stolper-Samuelson, which is a rise in the relative price of the labor-intensive good is compatible with the 2-0 profit conditions only if real wages in terms of either good rise. So W over P1 and W over P2. It doesn't matter what you consume. Real wages are going to rise regardless. And conversely, the return on capital is going to fall. It doesn't matter what you consume. So don't do that exercise that we just went through, which is focusing on what you consume. Worry about the relative price of labor-intensive versus capital-intensive product, right? Labor-intensive tradables versus capital-intensive tradables. I hope if there's questions, jump in here, and I'll try to make this more clear. So here's, I'm kind of, rather than just think in terms of mathematics, let's try to tell an equilibrium, a disequilibrium story that kind of makes us come alive in a way that mathematics doesn't. But the increase in the price of the labor-intensive good encourages capital and labor to shift from the capital-intensive sector to the labor-intensive sector. But all that capital is being released from the capital-intensive sector. Can't find a home in the labor-intensive sector because the labor-intensive sector doesn't need all the capital. It needs relatively large amounts of labor. The result is both sectors have to become more capital-intensive in order to absorb that released capital. When they become more capital intensive, then the real return to capital falls. I mean, it's a odd property of averages, but both sectors become more capital intensive, even though there's been no increase in capital. Both countries have, and consequently, you have increased capital intensity in both sectors, higher real wages, and lower real rental rates in both sectors because of those changes. Well, so I said, but are you serious? I still have to equal the score with Steve Davis at some time. Is he a labor economist or macroeconomist?
Macro.
I thought he was labor. I thought it was an epithet that I could throw at him. But an implication, you'll see this in a minute, is that the derived demand for labor is infinitely elastic. I mean, those two equations that we just inverted don't make any reference to labor supply. So you can change the labor supply and the wages stay exactly the same. So the only way that could be is if the labor demand curve were infinitely elastic, which is what the model implies. The reason that is because you have that external marketplace. You don't have to absorb the increase in labor domestically. You have the external marketplace to take advantage of. So he jumped on me, sort of, are you serious? Now, in order for that to happen, sewing machines have to be able to be turned into factories for making automobiles, that the capital labor has to be completely mobile between sectors. There's nothing sector-specific. So in the Ricardo Viner model, we have sector-specific assets, which are land and capital, but the capital in manufacturing is very sector specific for a long period of time. So we need to ask, in order to deploy this model, we need to ask how quickly the Heckscher-Lean clock ticks, because it takes a long time for the sewing machines to be turned into automobile assembly plants. You have to do the depreciation of sewing machines and slowly do the investing in the automobile activities. But let's think about the Stolper-Samuelson type of evidence. It's saying, let's look at the relative price of labor-intensive products compared to other products. And here we see, this is producer price index of textiles compared to the overall PPI now. This is not CPI. This is what the manufacturers are getting at the factory gate. CPI includes things that are imported. It includes service activities. This is manufacturing tradables. So we want to know what's happening to the relative price of labor-intensive tradables versus capital-intensive tradables. And the answer is, prior to the 60s, they were down by about 25%. The 70s into the early 80s, this is what I would call, I've been calling the Stolper-Samuelson decade, in which the relative price of labor-intensive tradables fell by about 50%. Then there's a long period of pretty stable, very stable relative prices, meaning that even though more globalization was going on, it wasn't affecting the prices at the factory gates in the United States. And I think I'll come back to this soon enough, but the reason is there's a market segmentation, with the Chinese focus on one set of products and the U.S. focuses on another set of products. Once that occurs, then the U.S. labor market is set loose from the Chinese labor market. The message of the Chinese liberalization, or the force that the Chinese liberalization has on the U.S. labor market, is carried through the prices of products that are made in the U.S. And if the force of that Chinese competition is to create a product upgrading within the U.S., you can create a disconnect between the product mix that originates in the U.S. and the product that originates in China. And I think that's what happened, although we had another big decline starting around 1997 in this relative producer price index. So let's look at real wages. So it's the same thing, manufacturing wages now, but divided by the consumer price index. And you can see things are moving ahead. This is the happy 60s in which everybody was getting wage increases. Then around the early 70s, this comes to an end. And relative to trend, we're down by about 27% in the period of the 80s, which is, or period of the 70s, which I was calling the Stolper-Samuelson decade, because that's when you had that big decline in the relative price of labor-intensive apparel. From then on, then we're sort of back on trend, not growing necessarily as rapidly as you did, but this is basically productivity improvement through this period of time. And then it looks like we set loose another round of Stolper-Samuelson effects, which is similar to the producer price picture that I had. All right, so the way to think about this at a conceptual level, I don't know how long you want me to blather along at this stuff, but the derived demand for labor looks like this. The way to measure the supply of labor is labor relative to available capital. The vertical is the real wage. There's a point in which you produce both products, you have a diversified mix of tradables. When you specialize in the capital-intensive product, then the increases in capital intensity will come with higher wages. If, on the other hand, you specialize in just a labor-intensive product, then the more labor you have, the lower will be the wage rate. So the derived demand for labor has a segment of elasticity, a segment of great, a segment of great elasticity. This is where your wages are going to be set by external competitiveness conditions. And then a segment over here. So I like to think of this as being Seattle. This is Los Angeles, and this over here is Shanghai or Beijing, meaning that at least a decade or two ago, meaning that the product originating from China was mostly labor-intensive product. The product originating from Seattle was mostly capital-intensive, which is Microsoft software and aircraft. And L.A. has this diversified mix, meaning that of all the cities in the U.S., we're the one with the most active apparel sector, competing with a foot in the third world, competing with the source of supply from these labor-abundant countries. But we also do aircraft and movies. We do the upper end as well. So think of the U.S. as in the middle of this enterprise. And then what happens if there's a increased competition which drives down the wages of unskilled workers? The answer is if you're up in Seattle, that's like a Ricardian effect. You get a pure terms of trade effect. You're not producing shirts in Seattle. So your Boeing aircraft can get turned into shirts at a much more favorable, instead of buying a 10 million shirts for a Boeing aircraft, now you can buy 20 million. So you're better off. In these countries that have enough capital so that their mix of manufacturing focuses on the higher end stuff, the most capital intensive, highest value added sectors, they benefit a pure Ricardian terms of trade improvement. If you're down here, if you're Mexico or Brazil or Indonesia and you're trying to compete in this labor-intensive activity,
your wages are being driven down by the Chinese competition. So if you ask me where is the force of the Chinese competition felt most, it's down here, which is Mexico. Now, unfortunately, Mexico was way late in their liberalization. Had they liberalized a decade or two earlier, they would have been the Taiwan of North America. But unfortunately, they liberalized and started to integrate with the U.S. economy at a period of time where the Chinese behemoth is there controlling product prices and driving down the margins, the value-added margins in these activities that were the traditional activities for and in the ladder of development, where you start at the lower end producing apparel and footwear, and then you move up with your investments in education, infrastructure, you move up that ladder. So the Chinese have basically eliminated the first couple of rungs on that ladder, making it pretty hard to experience significant development because you've got to kind of jump up forward the way you didn't historically. And then L.A., which sits here in the middle, L.A. has rising income inequality brought about by the fall in of apparel prices, meaning that the capital, human capital especially, gets a higher return in the L.A. region, and labor gets a lower return. So this, that's a little bit on its side. You can rotate that counterclockwise, 90 degrees in your head here. Yeah, I got to end in 5 minutes. I can go on forever here. This is saying that the 80s were the 70s were the silver standards in decade. This is a comparison of producer prices, and just reconfirming. And then the last item is so-called limit pricing. And I don't know if you know this model of limit pricing, but if you're a monopolist, then there's external competition, but it's high price competition. Your ideal solution is to just underprice that foreign competitor to prevent the foreign competitor from competing in your marketplace. So the foreign competitor says, well, we're going to improve our technology, we'll lower the marginal cost. Well, what limit pricing does is lower the price at home even more to prevent the foreign competitors from showing up. It's the threat of competition that causes lower prices in the U.S., but it leaves no trail. There's no imports that are actually occurring. All you see is lower prices. An example is really the auto sector. I mean, the UAW, which worked to was the glue that held the big three together. They, in a sense, monopolized the big three. Whoever was doing initial bargaining, they didn't have to worry about what the outcome was because the other two would go along and they would pass that on to the consumers. Consumer had nowhere else to go but to pay the whatever wages the UAW dictated. But with the rise of the foreign competition and the threat of Toyota and Nissan and now Hyundai, the threat of those products not covered by that same agreement, all of a sudden the UAW loses its market power almost completely. But you don't see that in any trade statistic. It's sort of the threat alone. And that makes it all the more difficult, and it yet more adds to the point that we're really in a three-fired logic situation. So I've got a bunch of slides in which I say I really think the big issue that this country faces is not globalization, but a transition from an industrial to a post-industrial society. And that every advanced country is having its fraction of workforce in manufacturing decline very substantially. Some of that has to do with using China as a global workforce, global manufacturing platform. But the big thing is the productivity improvements year after year are letting the few do the work of many. That force is constantly operating. Why didn't it operate during the first seven decades of the 20th century? Why didn't we end up with fewer and fewer manufacturing jobs, just like we ended up with fewer and fewer agricultural jobs in the 20th century? The answer, I think, is that the pace of product innovation was a whole lot greater in the first half of the 20th century than in the second half. So I don't know if you've seen that, is it 1800s house? Imagine that you were in a home in the 1900, in a kitchen of 1900, and then you were magically transferred into the kitchen of 1950. Well, there'd be a bewildering array of new kinds of products in that kitchen that you didn't have in 1900. You'd have an automobile, you'd have a television, you'd have a radio, you'd have an electric stove. you know, on and on, just dramatic difference in terms of the products that were in a typical American home in 1900 versus 1950. But then you take it from 1950 up to today, it's relatively minor, and it's mostly consumer electronics that is the big thing in during that period of time. And so I think that the reason that we haven't had the continued large fraction of in manufacturing is because the pace of innovation has focused on process innovation. Computerization, robotization have improved the process, increased productivity enormously, which is a job killer, not a job creator. It's the new products that tend to, that are the job creator, and we just haven't had an array of that. The reason that's important is we built the middle class in the factories of America. And now you got to wonder, what is a high school graduate possibly going to do? What kind of jobs are there out there? The answer, there isn't any. The jobs, the quality jobs, are in the intellectual service activities. And that requires a kind of talent as well as education, which is uncharacteristic of the jobs in manufacturing. The main thing in manufacturing that we had to teach our students that our high schools did pretty well on was to get to work and get to work on time and do what the boss says. So that's what our teachers kind of taught us. And if you didn't get to school on time and you didn't do what the teacher said, you kind of got the message quickly enough. You were prepared to go into manufacturing. Post-industrial service is totally different. You do not want to have the innovators in Hollywood or in Silicon Valley do what the boss says. It's not a hierarchical top-down kind of enterprise. It's a bottom-up entrepreneurial relationship-based kind of world that we're moving into. And the school systems that we have in place are still 20th century school systems. We're preparing kids as if there were still manufacturing jobs. There are no manufacturing jobs. But I think the most frightening thing is that the talent is a component, a critical component in a post-industrial service activities. And I don't know what kind of activities that you're familiar with. I know a lot about computer programming. I still do a lot of my own. There's only a small fraction of people who have the genetic talent to write commercially viable software. And if you thought of that as the only job, and then the electronic equipment and robots, et cetera, would do everything else, the world has ahead of us a labor market in which there's a few people who are designing the code, writing the code, and everybody else is competing with the robots, in effect, trying to do the same function that the robots are doing and getting paid about the same amount, which isn't very much. In other words, we're moving into a world which produces income inequality, which is uncharacteristic of the 20th century. It's going to have huge implications politically, I think. It's going to be very hard to deal with as it goes on year after year. Now, a lot of the income inequality that we had is the kind that you talked about, which is the financial sector. I mean, that's the quintessential point of income inequality with these investment bankers. And just to wrap up, I totally agree with your view with regard to the oligarchs and financial. I have a somewhat different perspective as a forecaster on this. You think about what the financial sector is supposed to do, there's two primary economic functions. One is to take our hard-earned savings and find the very best real investments. By real investments, I mean offices, factory equipment. We want to grow the economy. The way you grow it is to make sure our hard-earned savings are financing the best possible businesses, the best possible equipment, real investments. That's job number one. Well, let's talk about whether they're doing that very well. The fraction of GDP that is accruing to the financial sector went from, excluding the rents on real estate, so this is employee compensation, goes from about 4 or 5% to about 9% from 1970 until today. So we're paying an extra 5% of our hard-earned money to do this job, to make the economy grow. Well, the economy's been growing at 3% per year for 35 years. So there's absolutely no evidence in the long-term economic growth that we're getting anything for that return, for that payment. The second thing the financial sector is supposed to do is tell us how wealthy we are, because we need to know that, answer that, in order to decide what our savings rates ought to be, because we have to prepare for, sad to say, our inevitable retirements. And in order to do that, we need to know how wealthy we are. So that's the second function, and obviously the financial system has
woefully failed on that. Because 2 years ago, the financial system told us we were wealthy beyond belief, and today we're totally poor. And which is it? Which is it? It's crazy making. So the third thing that they do is they create gambling opportunities for us. So Bob wouldn't be able to buy a home unless he had insurance, fire insurance. So that financial package, that financial product, helps him buy a home. It helps the economy take on risk. So that's good. It's like a derivative. It just seems like not a bad thing to have happen. But if Dick and I want to place a bet on your home, and he thinks your home is going to burn down, and I think it's not, that doesn't really get you a lot. It doesn't do you a lot of good. But it's a gamble between Richard and myself, because when their home burns or doesn't burn, we just make a transfer of income from one to the other. But the credit default swaps are mostly in that character. So AIG bet big time that we would all pay our mortgages, that we would not default or go delinquent or default. And Goldman Sachs said bet the opposite way, and big time, with AIG. So now the taxpayers are making good on the gambles. And surely Goldman knew that there was an issue about whether AIG would ever be able to pay that back, that money. But they've got, through the mechanism that you're talking about, they have the front row in, every meeting. They've got the taxpayers making enormous channeling of money that goes through AIG, through all these other folks who happen to be on the other side of the bet. That's something that is beyond my comprehension. Why do we have to make good on bets that didn't have any material impact on where the economy's gone? Stop it. Okay.